This is Confessions of an Actress podcast, and I'm your host, Meredith Patterson. And on today's episode, I have my friend, straight from the Broadway production of Aladdin, Tony-nominated actor Jonathan Freeman.
Hi, honey. I'm so excited that I finally have you on my podcast. I don't know that I've seen you since being across the way at the Ford Center when we were doing 42nd Street together. I really just feel like, gosh, it's been a long time since I've seen your lovely face. But welcome to my podcast, and I'm happy to have you.
I don't even think it's called the Ford Center anymore. It's changed names like 20 times.
Oh, I know. Well, it was the Ford Center at the time, right? It was when the two theaters were pushed together, and then we opened that ginormous musical almost 20 years ago.
That's correct.
20 years ago next year. So,
wow.
And you are such a part of my childhood and so many people's childhood. And, you know, we're going to talk about so many things today that questions I've wanted to ask you since we had dressing rooms across from each other, which I probably did ask you back then, because I was just always in your dressing room asking you everything and making you do every line from Aladdin. So welcome.
Thank you.
Yes, for my audience that doesn't know, Jonathan and I met in 2001 when we were rehearsing 42nd Street on Broadway, which was just an enormously awesome show. But, you know, of course, we all know him as Jafar from Aladdin, all of us who grew up with that amazing movie. But I want to start way back in Ohio.
Okay.
Ohio, because you know what I know of you is just such amazing generosity. You really are somebody who gives back to kids and everything. And I know that you you're from Ohio and you started a musical theater. How did you get into doing theater, and what was it like growing up in Ohio?
Well, let's see. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, Eastern suburban Cleveland, Ohio. And there were many theaters actually at the time. It was a very, you know, growing up in Ohio, Northern Ohio was a very good time to grow up. You know, the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra is there, which is one of the best symphonies in the world. And they had children's concerts, just like, Bernstein was doing in New York, George Zell was doing them in Cleveland. There was the Cleveland Institute of Art, and there was the Cleveland Museum of Art that had art classes for kids. I luckily had a family that was interested in the arts, and my grandparents and my parents had subscriptions to the Hanna Theater, which at the time was the big touring house. And I was just having a good laugh the other day with my mother, in fact, because the first big, fancy, crazy show that I saw, which was the first national tour of Flower Drum Song, which came to the Hanna Theater, I was probably like, we're trying to figure out, I was probably like maybe no more than 8 or 9. And I was seeing Flower Drum Song, which has some very adult themes. And my mother was laughing. She was like, why did I can't believe they even took you to see that. It's kind of strange. And I was like, well, I'll tell you this. When they started that Fantantani number, do you remember that number, Fantantani? It's like basically a strip number.
I don't think I've ever seen Flower Drum Song.
Oh, but it's gorgeous. It's just, yeah, a beautiful, beautiful show. And there's a scene in a strip club, and these beautiful strippers come out, and they're basically wearing three fans, 1, 2, and 3, and the fans open and close. And I was like, it was like magic, you know? Not to mention that the stage is filled with smoke, and there's a slide. They slide down onto the, you know, these fantastic dancers. And anyway, so that's how I grew up having a lot of access, which access has a lot to do with your growing up. And I was very lucky, very fortunate. I feel very privileged to have had it. And luckily I can still laugh about Fantantani with my mom, with Gloria. And, so anyway, then there were children's theaters. There's the Children's Theater on the Heights, that became the Heights Youth Theater, and they had three theaters at the same time. One of them was a 3,000-seat amphitheater outdoor. And in the summertime, They hired, this was now, we're probably in the 60s by now. They hired these kids who were teen stars at the time. So like Tony Dow, who was on Leave It to Beaver, Paul Peterson, who was on The Donna Reed Show, Tommy Kirk, who was a Disney star as a young kid. And so we did like big Broadway musicals with teen stars. So like I played Marcellus Washburn in Music Man with Tommy Kirk playing Harold Hill.
That's amazing.
It was crazy.
Yeah, and it's a very different upbringing than I grew up in, you know, Northern California, where there was nobody coming from Broadway or from any really, you know, like amazing professional theater. And you already had all those influences, which I think, I mean, it had to have shaped you, or you know, a Flower Drum Song, and your mom probably blushing in the audience, like, oh my God, did I know this was going to be a pivotal moment? But it's, I always get so excited hearing about what it was, or what happened in your youth that sparked you and wanted you to make you do what you do, because it is just, you never know. And I'm a parent now. I'm a parent of two kids, and my oldest is about the age that you were when you went to go see Flower Drum Song. But yeah.
Well, here's what I think happened. When I was, I think, about eight, my parents were got divorced, and both lovely people, by the way. It was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And I think they just thought, you know, they hoped I would get involved in something. We went to see a play one day and I was like, I want to do that. And the next day I was like enrolled.
That's amazing.
That's how quickly it happened.
Yeah.
And so that was a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, it was
accidental. Yeah, you never know. And it's something that, like, you know, I think that exposing kids to the arts in general is a good thing. Obviously, not everybody's going to go off and do 11 Broadway shows like you have and be an iconic, you know, villain of Disney and all of the amazing things that you have done. But you never know. And you never know how that's going to either create a really great audience member, somebody who appreciates the arts, or somebody who is going to latch on and find their people and know that this is their passion.
Well, here's the thing that I realized, you know, obviously in retrospect, but a lot of the kids that I was at Children's Theater with, and the Youth Theater with, and Kane Park Amphitheater and the Cleveland Playhouse, where I did a couple things too, is that it's almost less about performing and being involved in the theater than what you learn while you're working on a show. Like, you learn how to collaborate with people, with friends, or with people you barely know. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, we have to do a scene together. I have to look in their eye and say lines, you know? And so it forces you as a really young person to learn how to form instant relationships that are good for working relationships, teaches you how to collaborate with other actors and musicians and prop people and costume people. And it teaches you at an early age a lot of things.
Yeah.
Those are valuable skills. I mean, those are really valuable skills going forward in life, no matter what you do. And even now when I coach, you know, at university level, the one thing that all my classes seem to lead to, whether it's musical theater coaching or Shakespeare or acting a song or whatever it is, it always leads to the collaborative process.
Yeah, it does.
You know, you have to have the language to be able to say, you know, to a conductor or to your piano player, you know, let's take it from the edge and put a little fire under it, or whatever, you know, whatever the language is that you need to use. You have to learn how to say it so you can communicate properly and develop relationships. And sometimes you have to do it really quickly.
I've never said that to a conductor. I need to say that next time I'm in a show. I need to learn how to say, let's put a little fire under it.
Let's put a little fire under it, honey. That's like old fashioned Broadway backstage talk. I love that kind of, you know, hard.
I love all of that. I love all of that. It's funny because
it's so ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. But you're so right. And I do feel bad for this, you know. It's been what, 10 months, 11 months, it feels like longer that we've all been not able to perform and not able to be in front of people. and all of these children who are being influenced by theater or trying to still do theater. I know I'm here doing outdoor theater with, we just did Aladdin Jr., which you were so amazing to.
I saw pieces of it.
So amazing for you to.
In the snow.
In the snow, and the Alpine Theater Project, which is the theater here, you know, it is just incredible. And we did this Aladdin Jr. outside, and my son started the whole show, and I was just like blown away by these children and the way that we're trying to figure out how we're going to do live theater in these moments, because we're all just starving for it. And we're all starving for that collaboration you're talking about. When you were saying that, I was like, God, I miss being able to look down at a pit and talk to a conductor and say, put a little fire in it, let's do it. And then tap dance or whatever.
Yeah.
How are you doing with all of that?
You know, I'm doing, yeah. Yeah.
It's a big question.
You know, because I was just, when March, you know, when the shutdown, the big shutdown came, I'd been doing Aladdin on Broadway for 6 years. It was kind of startling. Like at first I couldn't believe it would be more than a few weeks. I was like, oh, well, we'll be back at work in a few, you know. And that's what a lot of people thought. So the first thing was just kind of shock. And I'm still kind of in shock, I think. I can't believe it. It's a very strange thing to happen. And the only thing you can do is go day to day and try not to anticipate what's coming next or what isn't coming next. I've been trying to get involved in other things, as I think most people are, like yourself.
Yes.
Because that's what you have to do. I could have retired years ago already. I'm of the age, but I'm not, I never considered it, you know, and all of a sudden I'm like, wait, is this what retirement's going to be like? This is not for me.
No, I want to be like Betty White.
So I've got.
I don't want to ever retire, honestly, unless I don't love it anymore. That's when you know you have to leave. But you still love it. I can see it in you. Even in talking with you briefly over the phone when we were talking about you going back to. Tell me the story. You went back recently to the theater, and you hadn't been there since March.
Oh.
And I know it was. Yeah.
Well, I did a photo essay. There's a photographer named Matt Stokey who did a photo essay for Playbill Online, I think. I hope I've got it right. Or was it Broadway.com? I don't know. Oh, God. Sorry,
one of the
everybody.
Two.
Sorry, Matt. Anyway, it was a really interesting, and he started doing it just for himself. And then someone said, this is a great idea. Let's make it into something. So he photographed people who have been associated with plays, musicals, or theaters for a long chunk of time.
Yeah.
And photograph them outside in front of the theater, you know, they're boarded up theaters, wearing a mask or not, or, you know, whatever. But I think it's still going on, actually. You can find it. It's called Away From Home.
Okay. And, I think I saw something about that.
Yeah. So it's, I think, I don't know if it's monthly or I don't know how it is, but it's very interesting. And, you know, the people, it's very interesting. People have a lot to say, of course, about what's happening and how they feel. So the day that I went back to do the photo essay, I arranged with the management to go into the theater so I could go to my dressing room to get a couple of things. And, you know, instead of like the place crawling with people and stagehands and prop people and lighting people and sound people and costume people and many doormen that I knew. And there was like one door guy and like maybe a maintenance person wandering around, keeping things neat and pretty, as Mickey would say. I wanted to do it because I wanted to get a few things, but it was kind of a mistake. The theater was just as quiet as you can imagine. The elevator doors opened on my floor, on the third floor, and the first thing I saw was a windowsill full of dead plants. And it was so quiet, and every single thing was exactly where it had been in March. Every prop, you know, I have a huge amount of wardrobe. It's all hung in the same hangers in the same place when we walked out that one day. And it was kind of like, I mean, I hate to make light of it or Disney-fy it, but it was sort of like that scene in Sleeping Beauty when Princess Aurora pricks her finger on the spindle and the country falls asleep for 100 years.
Yeah.
That's what it was like. It was like nothing had changed. And then outside on the street, of course, I mean, 42nd Street even, like there were so many, not just theaters, you know, but businesses boarded up because there's no activity. I mean, there's a huge, and I mean, ridiculously huge McDonald's, like a few doors from the New Amsterdam Theater with a huge marquee because it had been a theater, closed. Hilton Theater on the same block, huge Hilton Theater, closed. And closed permanently, I hear, not just temporarily. So, yeah, that was my experience. And then there's no, you know, I mean, there are people walking on the streets who either were local or lived there, or maybe a few people were still going to their offices, you know, if it was a small office with no people in it, but nobody was in the building. And, you know, all of Disney East Coast is in the New Amsterdam Theater. So it wasn't just the people in our show, in our production. It was everybody that works there too, every day and daily basis.
Ooh, it just, you know, it just, it, I strange. Can't, I can't imagine New York the way you're describing it. And, you know, I lived there 18 years and I, the moment that all of this happened and the moment that Broadway shut down, my heart is still tethered to that community and to that part of the city. And I can't imagine thinking about the theater being closed that long. And when you said that, it was so haunting to me. I thought about 9/11 and when we, you know, it happened on that Tuesday, we went back to work on Thursday. And that was the most that I believe Broadway had been shut down. And we were all shell-shocked just from those few days. And I think that it's gonna take so much for everything to kind of recover. And I don't just mean financially or getting the show back in shape or when we all go back, it's really just the mental aspect of it all. And, you know, there's so many layers to it, but I feel for everybody so much, not just Broadway, but regional theaters, everybody who is a live performer, because it is affecting us so much, so differently than, let's say, you know, anyone who has a TV show, they're trying to figure all that out, but we're just left to wait.
Just right? Waiting. It's strange. It's, you know what the city is like now, Meredith. Do you remember? Well, I can tell you that how I've been describing it is Christmas Day, 1972, in the morning in New York City. So like when you get up on Christmas in New York City, it's much quieter than it usually is, than it ever is. That's kind of what it's like all the time now. There's still activity. There's things going on. There are people that, you know, that you can go to a doctor's office with all the protocols and masking and temperature taking and all that. It can be done, but it's very sort of like quiet. It's like blanketed. Everything is blanketed. I mean, that's what it is. And so it's unusual. And so it is strange and kind of ghostly because it's never like that. I moved there and yeah, the city that never sleeps is asleep.
The city that never sleeps is asleep.
Kind of.
Or, you know, sedated, if you will. And trying to figure all that out.
Very, yeah.
It's something that, I just, you know, if I actually really think about it, it's just devastating. And I know that the Broadway community is doing so many things to raise money and try to do, you know, online concerts and things like that. But it's not the same. And I know that we're all just waiting for that to come back. And I know Aladdin is going to come back. You're going to be back in it and you're going to put those costumes on again. For the first time since, and how is that? I mean, I just, if I was you, I would, that's what I would be kind of thinking about, like, how is that going to feel? And oh my God, the joy and the tears and all of it.
Yeah, it's going to feel weird. I will tell you though, just because you mentioned it's sort of that Broadway community is trying to do whatever they can. Mary Test and I don't know when, but a couple months ago, she posted that crazy picture of us from our show from 42nd Street. You know the section I'm talking about. Anyway,
I know exactly what you're talking about.
She posted the picture and it got like so many, such a huge reaction that somebody recommended that she and I do a live signing. So we're doing a live signing and then like...
How are you going to do a live signing? That's amazing.
Well, semi-live.
Semi-live.
I mean, alive. I'm going to tell you the exact date. I should have this in my head already, but here it is. The 10th, December 10th.
Okay.
It'll be live on, I think on Instagram. It'll just be me and Mary, and we have spent some time together. So we're sort of in our pod or whatever you call it.
Your COVID
very
crew.
Very isolated.
Yes, your COVID crew,
our
I guess.
COVID crew, yeah.
Everyone has their own name for it.
So it'll just be us like sitting at a table looking into a computer like this and, you know, and we'll be saying hi and then we'll be talking about, because we've done a lot of shows together, she and I.
I was going to ask, because I know you, before you did 42nd Street, you'd done On the Town together.
That's right.
Yeah, you guys have been friends because you just have this great chemistry together. I mean, whenever I just saw in the show, I was like, what great casting. They love each other. But you guys have always had that bond and that friendship.
Well, yeah, we also did a production of You Can't Take It With You that she played the Grand Duchess Olga Katrina and I was Boris Kolinkov, the Russian ballet teacher. And we just had some moments. Anyway, so I actually think probably we'll be talking about all of the shows we've done together and the mayhem that we have created in our wake. I don't know if you remember, even at 42nd Street, like the last night that Mary and I were on together. Do you remember that?
We
changed costumes.
Oh, I missed all of that because, you know,
Were you gone?
I was gone after the show.
Had you left?
Like a year and a half was as long as I stayed in the show. So it must have been Nadine. I think she was the closing Peggy. But, oh God, I would have loved to have seen that. I
don't remember.
I know.
Wait, we were there 2.5 years.
Oh, okay. So maybe.
Yep. Yeah, so for a curtain call. No? Wasn't, yeah, I don't even remember who, I have to be honest. After Kate and you, I lost track. It's terrible, but that's what happens.
That's
Plus
okay.
It was a huge show.
Yeah.
It was a huge company. And I have a feeling I won't ever do, well, I hope I will. I hope they will produce them. But when I did that show, I even said to Mary one day during our tech rehearsal, I said, you know what? We will probably never be in a show this glamorous and this big again, because I don't know, between Joop van Inden, was it? And I don't, they raised a lot of dough.
Yeah.
And it was spectacularly beautiful.
It was,
it really
amazing.
Was. I mean, was the company was spectacularly beautiful and huge. Anyway, I just can't imagine, you know, that we would, and the technology in the show also was so gorgeous.
It was a dream come true for me. I mean, it was my first Broadway musical. So I just was I went from doing, and I know you and I have this in common. We both done a Broadway show that lasted only a month. I went from doing a quote unquote flop for Julie Taymor called The Green Bird, which you could see the poster. It's right there.
Oh, I auditioned for that.
You did. I know exactly.
Yes.
I know exactly what part you would have auditioned for. And we're all puppetry and it was amazing. And it was the show after The Lion King that nothing ever happened. And you did Platinum. Like Bruce Valanche,
yes, I
think, wrote that.
Yes, Bruce Valanche. It starred Alexis Smith.
Yes.
Gorgeous. We were wonderful friends, actually. And it was a great, yeah, that was a great experience. And we were out of town. We rehearsed at the old Paramount lot.
Okay.
Because it was being financed by Paramount. And at the time, Michael Eisner was the head of Paramount. This is
nice.
This is like old history, but this is what, and so we rehearsed in LA on the Paramount lot. And then we went to, I think in this order, we went to Philadelphia and then to Washington DC before we came into New York. So it was a long trajectory. It was long. It was 1978. I think we started work on it.
Oh my gosh.
But you probably weren't even born yet.
I was born. I was born. I'm going to be, my birthday's tomorrow. I'm going to be 45. Because I remember I was 25 when I played Peggy.
Get out of here.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that crazy? So crazy. I know. But going back to 42nd
Street. It's your birthday tomorrow?
My birthday's tomorrow.
Happy birthday.
Thank you, honey.
If I'd known, I would have had a birthday cake.
You can sing me happy birthday as Jafar later in the podcast. Because you know I love you and I love.
It would be my pleasure.
So going back to our similarity, we had two Broadway shows that only lasted a month. That was my only other Broadway show that I had done. And then I moved to this ginormous, amazing show with all of these incredible Broadway dancers and stars, and you and Mary Testa and Christine Ebersole and Michael Kumsty and David Elder and all these people who I'd seen on Broadway. Because I saw you and She Loves Me when I moved to New York in 1994. I was just a wee thing. I just graduated from high school and moved to New York. And then I was like, so I had seen all of you guys on stage. And I just, and of course I was raised with the movie Aladdin and loved Disney villains. And, you know, and so just to be across the way from you and be in a show with you, you know, and opening up your door and asking you to do the voice of Jafar like every day. I'm just, you never got annoyed with me. You were always just such a lovely person and just so, so lovely to me. And that show, like you and Mary said, was epic. And I really don't think they're going to do, well, at least for a while until Broadway comes back financially, but I don't know that they could do a show like that anymore because there was like 100 of us. It was just massive.
Well, not 100, but
it feels like 100.
It was a lot of people. It looked like 100 and it looked like $1 million too. It was gorgeous. I mean, we had the most exquisite sets and costumes and wigs and shoes and oh my God, I can't believe it. You have the quintessential Broadway story that goes along with that. Have you ever told it on your show?
I've told it a little bit.
You want me to tell it? Are you going to tell it or you want me to tell it?
Do you want to talk about, is it the time when I went on in the middle of the show? Do you remember that story?
In the middle of a number in the middle of a show.
Yes, in the middle of a number in the middle of the show.
In the middle of a huge number.
I just remember Christine, which I have yet to interview Christine for the show, Christine Ebersole. She was doing Quarter to Nine, the song Quarter to Nine, with Kate, who I understudied at the time. She was Peggy. She ran off stage and I went on stage and did the number where Peggy became a star. So it literally was 5'5" Kate Levering or 5'4", she's much shorter than me. And then me 5'7". And I remember Todd Ellison in the pit didn't answer his phone. So he didn't know what was going on. So all of a sudden I'm posed, you know, on stage and he just drops his arms and goes, it's like, what's happening? What's going on? So I did the rest of the show as Peggy, but there was no way to announce it, right? Is that that's how you remember it?
No, I was remembering that they started that number, the big number, with the pianos that went around and the lids went down and they threw her up. And that Kate started the number. And when she started the number, she said to her dresser, I think, to your dresser, I think I'm going to be really sick. And so they got you ready. And so what I remember was at one point she spun off stage and you spun on like during the number. That's what I remember, but maybe that's not right.
I like that. It's much more cinematic than, but I did.
I thought that's what it was.
That might've been, because we said earlier, there was so many people that went in and out of, but I do remember she did Quarter to Nine. And then she, at this instance was the first time I'd ever gone on in the middle of a number or in the middle of the show. And Michael Kumsty, stopped the audience at the end of the show.
That's right.
And said, did anybody notice? And I think there was a few people in the front who maybe like could see the difference between us because we were different heights and all that stuff. But
two people.
But you
two,
used...
maybe two people. He asked the audience if anyone noticed that something weird happened, and two people raised their hands. One of them said, did the thief drop his bag during the ballet? And he said, yeah, but that happens 8 times a week. That's choreographed. Anybody else? And then another person said, I'm not sure, but it seems like the leading lady might have been different at one point. Did something happen? Like, really, in a huge theater like that, you would think more than two people would have noted. I mean, it's not that they didn't notice because they weren't paying attention. It's because they were so involved in the show and you were so terrific.
Thank you.
That no, they it, just
It's a good story. It's a good lesson.
They didn't think about it.
It's a good lesson. And I know you use that when you teach. You talk about, like, you know, it's a good lesson to not only be prepared as an understudy, you never know when you're going to go on, but what is the lesson that you teach with that story?
Well, the lesson that goes along with that is, I was once dealing with someone who had terrific stage fright.
Right.
And I was in a show, actually, which I won't say the name of the show or the person, because I don't want it to be embarrassing at all, because they were absolutely wonderful in the show, and confessed to me at one point about their terrible stage fright. And I said, "You are kidding me." And they said, "No." And I said, "Listen, I'm going to tell you a story." And I tell that story about how in the middle of a show, the leading lady changed. And I said, this is not to take away from anyone's performance. This is just to point out that when a show is good and an audience is paying attention, they don't see everything that you think they see. So you have to not listen to everything you think. You can't believe everything you think, because in a theater that has, you know, a couple thousand people in it that are all having the same experience, you just can't get, if you can just remember that they're watching the production, they're watching the show, they're watching you in it, that, you know, there's nothing to be afraid of. You know, there's natural nerves, of course, and excitement, but actual fear is a hard thing. I can imagine it, actually. I think I've had it occasionally, but I think if you just tell yourself, look, they're here to see all of it. They're not, no one's gonna, and when you change it, when you drop a word or a lyric in a scene or a song, that's not what it's about.
Well,
but we beat ourselves up.
Yeah. We do. You've never seemed like somebody who has any kind of stage fright or any kind of fear, really, of performing. But, you know, I think that that's such good advice.
You have to kind of, if you breathe through it, I'll tell a story on myself. When I was doing The Producers, I said to Brooks Ashmanskas, who was playing my partner, Carmen Gee, I was playing Roger Debris. I replaced Gary Beach, and Brooks Ashmanskas was playing Carmen Gia. And we had a short rehearsal period. And in fact, I don't know why, but the first day that we were both going on, we're sitting in our dressing rooms, and I heard the orchestra. And all of a sudden, I was like, I went to Brooks's dressing room. I said, "You know what? I just realized we've never heard the orchestra before." Like, why didn't we ask for an orchestra rehearsal? And he went, "I don't know." But it's true. So, and I suddenly was like, "Oh my God, am I going to be scared?" So I said to Brooks, "Listen, Brooks, if I ever look at you during the show and I say to you, 'I don't know what to say,' that means I've gone up on my line, I don't know what to say. So the ball is in your hands, okay?" And he was like, "Oh yeah, sure, fine." So one night I went up on a line or something, and I turned to Brooks and I said, "I don't know what to say." And he said, "Well, you better think of something, because it's your line." It's like, thanks a lot.
Well, there's moments when there's moments in shows where you just have, like, you just literally, whatever comes out of your mouth sometimes is what you say. And it's what makes live theater fun. It's what makes, you know, those connections with your other artists fun, when you can say, "I don't know what to say," and then they just throw it right back at you, and then you just you laugh, or you slip and fall, or whatever it is that happens in the course of a theater show.
No, you're so right.
I love.
Listen,
I,
as long as nobody gets hurt.
As long as nobody gets hurt, that's the truth.
Yeah.
As long as nobody gets hurt, it's all it's just a play. So play. That's what I used to tell myself whenever I would walk out on stage, you know, to sing 42nd Street on 42nd Street in a pin spot, and I started to think of the enormity of all of this, I would say, "Hey, Mayor, it's just a play. So play. Like, you are lucky to be
that's
here."
Right.
I would, every show I would, I, if those nerves hit me, that's what I would think. I was like, this is just a play. And, you know, I can't leave this interview without having you do a little bit of play as Jafar for me, because as I said before, many times I used to ask you to, you know, do the voice every day, and you would come up behind me. And I don't even know if you remember this, but you would come up behind me in the, you know, when I would be in the wings and you would just go, Meredith. And this is just, you would just give me a little, it was like a two-show day. I needed a little energy. And you would just make me giggle by just saying something as Jafar. So to end this amazing interview that I literally feel like I could talk to you forever because I just adore you.
Well, we can do part two someday.
We can do part two. Yes, we'll do part two. When you go back to Aladdin, and I say when, and you put on those costumes again, and everybody gets to experience you as Jafar live, and hopefully I will get to as well, because I would love to come and bring my boys to the theater, then we'll do part two.
It's a beautiful show. It really is a beautiful show, I have to say. I mean, it was interesting. The changes that they made were, I mean, a lot of people think there's a lot of new material, and there is some new material. A lot of it is material that was in the film that was cut.
Oh, wow.
That they managed to put back in. So Alan Menken was kind of eager, I think, to honor some of the work that he had done with Howard Ashman, who was, passed away.
I know that you, I believe this story, that I remember it correctly, that you recorded one of the last songs with Howard before he passed away. And I did Christmas Carol with Alan Menken and Lynn Ahrens for 3 years. He gave me my first ever job in New York. So, the community is small. The community is we all love each other so much. But we could do a whole part two just about Aladdin, honestly. You have a lot of stories. I know that this is one of the questions I wanted to ask. Were you blind? Were there people blindfolded when you auditioned for Jafar? When you auditioned for The Voice, or in the audition process, I heard something about that they didn't want to have the way you look influence they wanted to just have it be The Voice, which I think is such an interesting way of casting.
Right. Well, they weren't blindfolded exactly, but this is what happened. No, but they may as well have been. First of all, it's hard to talk about it a little bit because it's before a lot of technology. You know, like when I auditioned, I went into a room with my accompanist, and one guy was in the room, Albert Tavares, with a reel-to-reel tape recorder recording my song and the scenes that I was asked to bring in. That was it. Then at my callback, I went to the callback and it was a whole other experience because it's Disney. It was very glamorous. They had whatever room we were in, they had it, it was fully draped for sound. And there was like a platform at one end of the rehearsal studio that you would step up onto. And there was a microphone there and the piano player was up there with you. And then they said, you know, we just want you to do the same audition you did last time. We just need to hear it again. And I said, great. You know, thinking to myself, if I could only remember what I did last time, it would be really good. And as I started, at that time, instead of one person in the room, there were probably a dozen people in the room and a lot of them wearing suits and looking all, you know, neat and pretty. And I didn't even know who they all were. I mean, it was like probably Alan Menken, maybe Howard was there. Producers, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's like going to a room full of producers. This is what happened is I started my audition. When I started auditioning, they all went like this.
This is a terrible thing. That actually, unless you knew it there, you didn't know what was going on, or were they just covering their eyes?
Well, to be honest, you know, this is so strange how actors' minds work. As I was doing the audition, I was figuring it out in my head. I was doing my audition and thinking, what is going on in the room? Should I stop? Have I done something wrong? You know, no, surely, John, someone will stop. You just keep going. And this is all going on while I'm doing my audition, while I'm singing my song again and getting ready to do scenes. No, I kind of figured it out. It was like, oh yeah, this is for the voice of an animated character. And I had seen some preliminary drawings and I knew I didn't look like any of them. And in fact, when I went into audition, there was a wonderful actor also with the callbacks, whose name was Tony Azito, also passed away, sadly. He was a wonderful actor and he was very tall and very skinny. And as I went into my audition, I saw him, I thought, oh, he's gonna get it.
You never know. Yeah, that's the one thing you never know. And we all have that stuff going on when we're auditioning, at least, you know, at least I do. I'm exactly the same way, where I will be in the middle of performing and I'll be like, why are they eating their sandwich? Am I not helping them? You know, I don't know. Am I doing something wrong? Or all those like things that we do to ourselves, that doesn't help. But clearly you did a great job. You know, because you booked it.
Well, it was, you know, there were 6 month periods in between, like after I auditioned, there was 6 months before the callback. And I think another 6 months almost before I booked it, right before Christmas of 1990. So that was because I started work in January of 1991. And they rushed me into the studio to start to demo a song, which was the last song that Howard wrote, called Humiliate the Boy. Wonderful song. Didn't make it into the movie, but other ones did. And so it was a very long trajectory, and I was excited and happy, but my agent called and said Merry Christmas that year, 1990.
Merry Christmas. That was, we all got a gift that day. And what
you're sweet.
It's so true. You know, it's really funny because it is such every Disney villain. And like I said, I have such an admiration for Disney villains. You know, I much more want to be a Disney villain than a princess. I don't know why. And so maybe someday I'll get this dream come true. But this was a dream come true for you to voice an animated character. Yeah. And not only that, but just such an iconic one.
Well, to voice an animated, to voice a villain. And you said you don't know why you want to. I know why. It's because first of all, the scale of the characters is always crazy, outrageous, even when it's like totally believable. They always have like the best wardrobe. It always looks like they have like, you know, the most fun. And they usually have like talking pets.
Exactly.
So who doesn't want to have that?
Exactly. Exactly.
It's a lot more fun.
So just for me, to appease me, because I haven't had you to do the voice for me alone in 20 years, would you do a little happy birthday message to me?
I would be delighted. I should say we would be delighted. Meredith, from me and from Jafar, happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Meredith. Happy birthday to you and many more. Happy birthday, Meredith. May all your wishes come true. Three, of course.
I love you so, so much. Thank you for that. I will
only
cheers.
For you.
He's not available for birthday messages, everyone. Mm-hmm. It's just me. Oh, I love you. I'm putting my glasses on just for you.
No,
hi, honey.
Twins now.
And thank you for this amazing time together. I adore you more than you know. And I can't wait for part two.
All right. Anytime.
So you're the best. The best ever.
To support this podcast, make a donation, or become a sponsor, visit confessionsofanactress.com. Subscribe, like, and share your favorite episodes on all your social media platforms, and be sure to tag us at Confessions of an Actress. And if you're feeling extra generous, leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. I really appreciate the love. And remember, have vision for what you want and be grateful for where you are every single day. Take care of yourselves.